folks, if you would like to chime in with a question, the best way to do it is to do it with a super chat. It helps us out and we very much appreciate it. We do have to do fundraising constantly to keep ourselves on the air, to pay for our programs, and it's very, very helpful. So yeah, break out your credit card, go to Entropy, leave a tip on Odyssey, and we will get to that. Let me run through the Entropy questions that we have now. Wife Waffen has written in with $7, and she says, thank you. And then she writes in with another $3. She says, I've been going through the Jeff Costello archives and noticed something that I thought was interesting. In the 2010s, the comments seemed to be more authoritarian and less moderate than today. And then she sends another $3. They also seem to be not around anymore, some of the commentators. Does this represent a black pill cycle? I have seen the same thing on Gab. People go further right until they despair. Am I imagining this? So this is an interesting question. I would love to talk to Angelo Plume about this because he went through the whole Countercurrents archives over a period of a month doing work on the photos and captions and stuff just to make sure that everything was properly captioned and that we weren't using things that weren't in the public domain. We just wanted to make it all legal. So anyway, he noticed a lot of patterns, and I wonder if he would have noticed that pattern. I'll ask him about that. So there was a certain authoritarian tone to a lot of the commentators in the early years of Countercurrents, and a lot of these people are gone. I'm trying to think of some of those people. It's interesting. I've looked at, we have a top 100 commentators list, and looking through that list, I know that some of the people on that list have died. People die. We've had a number of writers who have died over the nearly 14 years that Countercurrents has been in existence. Leo Yankevich died. Marion Van Court died. Charlie Kraft died. So there are a number of people who contributed to Countercurrents as writers who died, and a number of commentators who died. I'm pretty sure the guy who commented as White Republican died. He also commentated, I think, as commented as proofreader. There was a few others that I don't need to name, but some people have died. But there were a lot of people who were sort of, I don't know, like you said, authoritarian. And maybe they did black pill and drop out. I don't know. Maybe they thought I was a giant cuck on a lot of matters. It's an interesting question. But you know, I made very, very clear early on in Countercurrents that there's a difference between the new right and the old right. And I actually mean that. I really mean it. And I think that people who are re-envisioning some kind of one-party dictatorship, some kind of uniformed political paramilitary movement, or something involving guns and violence, that's not the way forward, and that's a trap, actually, and I've emphasized this for years, and I think some of the people who believe that finally got it through their heads that, yeah, I'm serious about this, and they started gravitating towards other sites that were more receptive to that. Maybe that's one of the factors. I don't know. David, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, first, I think it's people might have realized that, you know, there's this issue with the religious right failing, and okay, has real Christian nationalism never been tried? It's the same thing with authoritarianism. Has real authoritarianism ever been tried? At some point, if you keep failing and you keep doing the same stuff and it's so cliche, maybe you need to rethink it. Doesn't mean that it doesn't have some merit, but there's obviously a problem here. If you keep trying, it's like the definition of insanity is trying the same thing over and over and expecting different results. So yeah, we probably do need to rethink this. Also, I wouldn't be surprised if some of this had to do with the alt-right in 2016, where you had a huge influx of libertarians.
Yeah, true.
And now I'm going to talk out of both sides of my mouth. Many of those libertarians, like myself, went the whole opposite direction of our libertarian past. We went running in the exact opposite direction to the whole other quadrant of the political compass. But then again, maybe we kind of like moderated and simmered down after a while and like didn't revert to being libertarians, but did that. Also, I've raised that the revolutionary conservatives have been popularized, like Ernst Younger, who had a very strong anti-authoritarian bent to his writings, especially after World War II. And two, if you read Julius Evelyn, I mean, actually read him and not simply just be content with a schizophrenic TikTok video about the Monocle Man. He was not authoritarian at all. He actually had quite a few constructive criticisms of that. Of that being degenerate or washed out or simply form. Like he wants a total organic, he would recommend an organic state, but not a total state, not a totalist state. So there's that. So I think that's happening too. And two, I think people, it's getting less cultish because we are going more mainstream, and we do see people taking up our talking points. So I think it's helping people get out of the ghetto too. And two, I think people also, this before it was all about certain regimes and people, but now people are discovering other figures like Franco or Horthy Miklos, who were hard right, but they weren't authoritarian. They were actually pretty moderate, if you really think about it. And that showed that this does work, actually. So I think there's a number of I think those factors are all probably working together.
Right. One of the things that I've stressed is that no matter how you think this is ultimately going to play out, whether you think that your totalitarian political party of fanatics is going to institute a forthright dictatorship, or that it's going to change in ways that you can't even imagine, in the meantime, we're going to have to spend a lot of energy on propaganda. We're going to have to change a lot of people's minds. And a lot of the people who had the 1920s, 1930s interwar fascist model, and who dream of a dictator, of a strong man who's going to put everything in order. What drives that is a sense of hopelessness, that the whole world is against us, that people are so stupid, that there's so many of the non-whites and anti-whites, that there's no possible way that anything is going to coalesce into something that we want without a strong man taking over and just forcing it through. I really strongly think that that's a lot of the way a lot of people believe. And believe me, there was a time, I remember I started this in 2010, when we were in the Obama years and people were deeply blue-pilled. And it was very, very hard to imagine, for instance, we would ever get the mainstream to debate whether globalization was a good thing at all, whether free trade was a good thing, whether open borders and multiculturalism is a good thing. Those were totally beyond the pale of polite conversation. Those are outside the Overton window, outside the possibility of being debated, outside the possibility of people running on those things. The consensus of the establishment, the hegemony of these liberal, globalist, multiculturalist values was absolute. And so, yeah, you think there's nothing we could do but have a miraculous ascension of a strong man who could force everything to go our way. Well, 2015 came along. Well, first of all, 2014. 2014, we had Black Lives Matter. We had Trayvon. And then we had what's his face? I've forgotten him. I'm glad I've forgotten him. Hands up, don't shoot. Yeah, Mr. Skittles, and then hands up, don't shoot, whatever his name was.
Skittles and iced tea is a communion they do at some black churches now. I'm not making this up.
Yeah, let them. For all the good it will do them, let them. Anyway, the Black Lives Matter, Trayvon and Michael Brown, was it Michael Brown? Something Brown. They drove a lot of people in our direction, interestingly enough. We saw an uptick in discussion. Why? Because it was such flagrant lying, and people saw through it. There were so many contradictions. There were enough cracks in the system where truth could percolate through because of social media. People started getting indignant, and people started ending up in our camp because of it. One of our best writers for years, Aidan Cassiel, he came to us through picking holes in the Trayvon Martin narrative, fascinatingly enough. So anyway, that was a big uptick. Then the migrant crisis. Again, another big uptick came from that. But the thing that really, I think, changed a lot of people's thinking about strategy and about how we're going to change the world was when Trump came along in 2015. And on his first day, when he announced his candidacy, he put globalization, multiculturalism, immigration on the table as things that would be competed about again. And that changed the paradigm. And then suddenly people started realizing, wait, you know, if we can change the parameters of debate, if we can chip away against this artificial, brittle consensus, we can start making headway. And of course, part of that was the hope that Trump would be the strong man, right? That those kinds of hopes die hard. Of course, now we've been disillusioned about that. But just the fact that our ideas and memes are getting more and more widespread is very, very encouraging. And we haven't done that with a party marching lockstep or anything like that. We tried marching around wearing polo shirts and carrying tiki torches. We tried that. That was smashed up fairly successfully, but the ideas continue to spread. And my vision that I have put forward is this. I'm an agnostic about how this is all going to end. Eventually, it's going to end when an organized group of white nationalists in America simply smash the current power structure and take control. And by smashing the power structure, I mean replace the current elites, entirely replace them and assume control. How do we get to that point? That's the question. And we might get to that point simply by converting so many people to our way of thinking that the change at the end would be basically bloodless, that there would just be no consensus to keep up the charade. They would look around and realize they don't have enough people on their side. They've got all these institutions, but these institutions can be, you know, they'll realize that they've got nothing anymore, that they've lost all their cards. They might have nominal control of institutions, but nobody believes their bullshit anymore, and it might collapse. It might collapse very much in the way that communism collapsed, in an almost bloodless internal collapse. That is a possibility, and that's the vision that I most cherish, and that's what I want to pursue. That's the strategy. Metapolitics, metapolitics, metapolitics. If we change the way enough people think, the political stuff will sort itself out, and we don't have to decide on a particular political model or organization before that time. So that's my hope. And I think more people think that way now. So maybe that tone, that sense that we need to build a party, we need to build a hierarchical political organization, that's dissipated because people see more possibilities available now. I think that's what's going on. I'm sure there are factors that we haven't named, but I think that's what's going on. We're realizing that a metapolitical strategy might not be entirely enough, but at this stage in history that we're in, it's what we can do effectively. And we are doing it effectively. And if we do keep doing more and more of it, we might actually get to this beatific vision of the system just collapsing because nobody believes the bullshit anymore. And we will have a cadre of people in prepared to just say, okay, this is what we need to do. And there won't be any basic difficult to quell resistance at that point. I mean, it's utopian, but it's a possibility. And that's sort of what I'm pursuing. And that allows me to be totally on the side of the angels, right? I'm going to persuade with my silver tongue the world to change. Okay. Enough people think that that's a good enough approach now that we should keep pushing for that. And chances are the things are going to work out our way. Anyway, so that's a long answer to an interesting question. Let's go back to entropy.
Yeah. I just want to make two quick points if you don't mind. The first one, too, is that I think Richard Spencer really burned a lot of people out, where any energy I had for authoritarianism was pretty much burned up by Spencer. Like, I'm not going to jump on another cult of personality after all that. So people are done with that. I think he really was a strong example why that will not work or should not work, or why we should have like multiple good leaders instead of just one that we all worship. That's someone who wants that fewer job probably is not fit to be fewer. I'll just say that. And the other thing too, is that going off about making the system collapse, is that I've been hammering home the idea of a white boycott in the military, and we've done good jobs on that, but we can do even better. I think this summer we're going to have a libtard boycott of the military because they're all up in arms about Gaza. And you'd be surprised how many liberal or apolitical people are in the military, especially the Army and Navy. I mean, Air Force and Navy. And so this summer, their recruitment numbers are probably going to take a hit from both white people being dumb and Brandon and then liberals being up in arms about Gaza. So what might happen is that if they don't have a military, they can't defend their decaying empire. At some point, they'll be forced to come back to us. And I don't think we should ever enlist again, but I think we could do is create private military companies like Blackwater, like Eric Prince had. At that point, I'll just say this. When you control the military, you control force. You control the power. Let the courts make let Congress and the courts make their stupid noises. They basically have no power then. And I know it sounds very subversive, but it's true. This is how the Germans took over Rome, the Fodoradii. They were the ones in power. Alaric the Visigoth just realized, I'm in charge. Why shouldn't I just tell you to shut up because you're being stupid? And we can do that, and there will be no pushback because there will be nobody to push back against us.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Sesto Fior writes in with $15. What do you think of the idea of whites being the head of a global body and other racial groups representing other parts of that body, like blacks representing the reproductive organs? Hoo boy. Well, why don't you sound off on that, David? What do you think of the idea of whites being the head of a global body and other racial groups representing other parts of that body, like blacks representing the reproductive organs? Well, let me just say something.
I completely disagree.
Yeah, go ahead. I want to hear your disagreement before I chime in with mine.
So the ancient Greeks, and Greg's an expert on this, they had their idea of like a society being a body. Like we talk about the body politic, and you had different peoples doing different functions. For example, and you had warriors, priests, workers. And here's the thing, those societies that were all white, like ancient Greece, they were complete unto themselves. They were not lacking something. So this idea of a interracial, international, global organization doesn't make sense because it'd be like fusing bodies together. We're already complete. So this would be like separate people fusing each other, and they, you know, organs reject each other too. Because whites, they can do all that. We provide people who perform every single function in the body politic, like our thinkers, administrators, workers, soldiers, farmers. We have the full deal.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. We don't need other races to survive, and we should not think of ourselves as grafting ourselves on to other races as some kind of ruling group. That's the mentality of a parasite. And that's not a model for us. So my view is no, I do not want to be part of a global society, an organic part of a global society. I want all the different races to live in their own spheres and be as independent as they possibly can be. And I do not want whites to basically take a role as, you know, global rulers or global nannies. Now, yeah, there are some things that are very tempting. Now, you know, you can get people tempted with this role. They'll say, well, look, only white people care about the environment. Only white people care about global issues, so shouldn't we take some kind of responsibility for that kind of stuff? Global responsibility, right? Well, yes and no. Certainly no in the sense that we should become some sort of specialized organ, the head of the global body. We should be complete unto ourselves. But it might be the case that, yes, whites and other more advanced societies in the Far East would take a leading role in global treaties regulating carbon emissions or pollution, stuff like that. I think that's perfectly reasonable. But no, I don't like the idea of us being part of a global body politic. I would like to remain as aloof from that kind of model as humanly possible. We don't benefit at all from that. Yeah, so Jasper writes in with $500. Wow, that's very generous. Thank you. Would the dissident right in particular, and white America more broadly, be better off if Trump were to lose the upcoming election? P.S. Could you apply this donation to renewing my annual membership? Absolutely. In fact, I think we can probably renew that. Yes, we'll take care of that right away. Thank you so much. So would the dissident right in particular and white America more broadly be better off if Trump were to lose the upcoming election? Let me share my thoughts on that and then pass it to David. I would say that it's possible that we could be better off if Trump loses the election. It's possible. A lot of good things have happened for us on the right because Trump was robbed of the presidency in the last election. I, of course, believed that it was the responsible thing to do for whites is to vote for Trump back in the last election. And I will probably end up saying that again in this election, although he really has reduced a lot of my goodwill, as have all Republicans with their disgusting, shameless behavior as slaves and whores of Israel recently. But let's say that I come to accept the argument that it would probably be better for us if he got elected. Why would it be better? Well, the main reason that I put forward was that Trump slowed down the Great Replacement during his administration. He didn't build a wall, but he did a lot of things to slow down immigration. And that gives us the most precious thing, which is time. I didn't believe that Trump was going to save us the first time around. I don't think he'll save us if he gets a second presidency. If he gives us more time, then we will be able to save us. And by we, I mean racially conscious white people will be able to propagandize and organize to the point where we can actually save white people on North America. That's what I hope. However, I do have to acknowledge that what happened under Biden is what I predicted would happen under Biden, namely the gates would be open and millions of people would flood in and the Great Replacement would go into overdrive. That's exactly what's happened. The Great Replacement went into overdrive. Fortunately for us, luckily for us, the response of the public has been healthy. There has been a healthy amount of pushback against this. There's been a lot of people have been awakened by this. And that's the best possible thing that we could hope for from this. You know, it didn't wake up the South Africans in time, right? But this seems to be waking up a lot of people. So maybe this was good. But let's not get ourselves into this crazy idea that it's a strategy for winning to lose, right? Which is the way a lot of accelerationist types talk. How do we win? Well, things get so bad, we keep losing so badly that somehow magically we'll get tired of it and win. This was what Breton Tarrant, remember the shooter in New Zealand, he wanted to spark a crackdown on our First and Second Amendment rights around the white world, thinking that once we no longer have the ability to communicate with one another and share our ideas, and we no longer have the ability to take up arms against our oppressors, that somehow without those means, we'll be more willing and able to win than we were with those means, which just strikes me as completely insane. He was a total idiot. Okay, so I remember years ago, it was in 2016, somebody asked me in one of these streams, Greg, do you think it might be better for us to support Hillary? Was it Hillary that he was running? Oh yeah, in 2016, he was running against Hillary Clinton. Should we support Hillary, you know, to wake up people, you know, for acceleration purposes? And my action was, you know, at some point, we've got to take the win. And I looked at Trump in 2016 as a win because he had already put immigration and globalization back on the table as competing points. And there was every reason to think that once he got into office, he would actually do some of that stuff to move things forward, which is what we wanted. And so it was frustrating to me to hear people think, you know, maybe the smart thing to do is snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, because people will get so upset that maybe then we'll do some winning. Well, we'll never win unless we actually take the win when it's available to us, when it's offered to us. And so I look on the idea of Trump losing as, well, maybe he'll lose, maybe he'll win. But the idea that him losing should be our strategy, you know, for winning, strikes me as crazy. That sounds like crazy talk to me. I'm also very confident that no matter what the outcome is of this election, whether Trump wins, Trump loses, we will still be able to make headway. We'll still be able to bounce back from it. We'll still be able to use that to change people's minds. There will be endless opportunities for us to comment and show the relevance of our ideas, no matter what the outcome of this election. That being said, what I would like this election to bring about is a slowdown of the great replacement. I'd like to see not just a slowdown, I'd like to see a reversal. And there's a substantial number of Americans who now want that. More Americans want to send millions of people back now than have ever wanted that, certainly since 2015, 2016. There is a tremendous consensus for getting rid of these people. And if we can get a guy in who will actually push to do it and maybe actually do some of it, that would be a good thing. That's a win that we should want to take. So we just simply have to give up on this idea that we can win by losing. Accelerationism basically, I think, functions as a coping mechanism, right? Something terrible happens. Something bad happens. Imagine Hillary got elected. Well, one of the things that people would be saying the next morning in our chats would be, well, at least this will wake people up because it's going to get really, really bad and really crazy, and it's going to be grist for our mill. That's a coping mechanism, and it's fine to cope that way. But we shouldn't turn a coping mechanism into a grand 5D chess move that basically gets white nationalists addicted to the idea that the way forward, the way to victory, is to lose enough. We just need to lose another round, guys, and then we're going to win. Because with each round that we lose, we have fewer white people in America. We have less money. We have less money in the form of economic power. We have less political power. We have fewer rights. You can't keep reiterating that downward spiral and think that at a certain point, when we get to almost nothing, there'll be some miraculous, and this really would be miraculous, it's a deus ex machina, we'd get so upset that we would just change everything. That's no way to think about this. David, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I think political habits are formed, and one of the habits we're trying to break is the beautiful losers of conservatives. And I think in a similar vein, if we were to keep losing and losing, we'd have to break another habit, which is this accelerationist wingnut idea that we should just lose. Like, no, we need to, this is a bad habit and we need to break it. And if this were to happen, defeat after defeat, the common masses would be demoralized, beaten down, and they would just give up probably. These people do not have very much revolutionary potential. They need some form of hope, and they would have no hope. And two, this is all very, it's a bunch of conjecture and speculation. I'd rather have one hen in hand instead of two in the woods. Like, there's a lot more moving parts with the accelerationist game plan, like ping-ponging off of this stuff. And that's all, the more moving parts you have, the more things that can go wrong. And the other thing too is that, like you said, let's do some deportations now. We can act now. But too, I think Trump winning would be great for a national divorce, because if the liberals will absolutely freak out and they're going to overreact. And if this happens, we can have, say, if they want to have sanctuary cities, they don't want to do mass deportations. Well, what we can do is just have a national divorce where we chop off these. They might actually suggest it themselves at that point, but if not, we can simply say, you're in a state of rebellion, you're out of the union, we're not going to declare war on you, but you're gone. Bye, Felicia. We don't want you. You're kicked out. You're kicked off the island. And we can take all these rotting, like, liberal enclaves are like rotting limbs of decay and multiculturalism and depravity. Just hack them off and let them, you know, they'll have to sink or swim on their own. And I did an article recently on the Holman Institute about how all federal money is actually state money, and how there's not a huge difference between the different states, actually, between red and blue for what they contribute. So this whole idea that we would be, you know, only red states would be left after we either kick the blue states out or they leave, or we'd be destitute without California. That's not true, actually. We would be just fine, whether that's with a national divorce or if we keep the federal government, but it's a Republican government. So that's a complete myth. We don't need these people. We don't need their money. And I think that's good. I think we need to kick these people out. National divorce is good. And two, I think if Biden were to win, it'd become stagnant. There's something metaphysical here where Hillary, Obama, they're just pure stagnation. Nothing happened. A lot of Biden's presidency was stagnant too. It was, you know, a touch of the Soviet Union. But it felt like history came to a standstill until the empire began to unravel. And so I think Biden winning, it would allow them to accustom our people to losing more. It would actually put people to sleep. They simply put their heads down. They have no hope. Republicans wouldn't dare do national divorce because they'd be afraid of being January 6th. That was on purpose. And they would just become like the last man, kind of. And Biden would be able to solidify a bunch of stuff, normalize a bunch of stuff, the country would get browner, and I think that'd be very bad. This because the energy would be sucked out. And two, if Biden were to win, first of all, if Trump wins, that proves that our populist platform works. And that is despite America being more brown than in 2016. 8 years is a long time for demographics. So that means that this is a winning strategy. It vindicates populist national strategies. And it means that the Republican strategy is a losing strategy. And at this point, if they're doing it, they're losing on purpose, and they need to be destroyed. While a Biden victory would kind of vindicate the rhinos as, oh, we need to just adjust the new order here.
Yeah, that is a good point. Let me zip back over to Entropy. We've got more super chats tumbling in. So let's take these. K Max McDonald writes in with $10. What jumped out at you about the survey or poll that 540 people just turned in, the recent poll that we did of Countercurrents readers? Was it the personality type, Jared Taylor being referenced the most? What interesting results jumped out at you? Was there good advice in it to grow as a movement, learning lessons from the past?
All right, so right now I'm still analyzing it because I have to go through and cross-reference different sections. We had like 115 questions. Not all of them are data points, so that's like 100 questions. And you can cross-reference section with sections, so that's 100 times 100. I'm not going to do 100 courses. It's going to be like 2 to 5 sections that I cross-reference with the other sections. But so this will probably take weeks and weeks. And questions might pop up months later that we want to explore. But right now, what did pop up the most was the INTJ thing. That's our greatest strength and our greatest weakness. We're 46% of us are INTJ. That's great. We have great back-end leaders. But we have a huge issue with relating to the normies because we are not normies. And so that's a huge thing we have to cross. The same thing with the IQ, 130 average IQ. That's great for masterminds, but there's a problem where people can't relate with people who are 115 IQs above or below them. So again, we have a huge issue with normie outreach. So I think we need to craft I'm going to definitely be studying the people who are non-INTJ, especially the more normie personality types. I'm probably going to even do in-depth one-on-one interviews with people who have the normie types to explore their red pill journey in greater depth. Because they ironically have, even though they're more widespread than the population, they're very rare for us, so they're actually more valuable. And two, how they got red pilled and their barriers and how they think, well, that's, well, we can apply that to the rest of society that we're trying to change. Like, we have our cadre here. We have our Dark Lords, our Nazgul, our masterminds, but we need to put them to use. Like the NJP and others, they thought that they had their, is ready for a mass mobilization of a party. Well, no, we're ready for a mass mobilization of masterminds. We have the lions rallied, but how do we get to the people? That's a huge step we need to do. And that just requires further research, which will probably be highly intensive. I might be working with Ryan Sanchez, my friend on that for the Nationalist Network, because he's good with people. So he'd be good at interviewing people either off the street or countercurrents people one-on-one and just having them maybe do 30 to 60 minutes intensive interview. The other thing too is the herb is that there's been a change in, and Greg cut me off if I start revealing classified information. I mean, it's not actually classified, but movement sensitive information.
Sure.
Yeah, a lot of them are urban. So the youth took a turn towards being urban, which I found very strange. A lot less suburban and rural than either the national average or the countercurrents average. And I think something's up there. That might be because, you know, going to an urban environment means you're exposed to diversity. They might be in a college town, so that just makes sense. But something is there, and I'm going to explore that more. I might have to do interviews on that, too.
Yeah, that's great. I was very impressed by a couple of things in this poll. And they're the things that we shared. We're not going to share a lot of the information, but we're going to share some of it that will make people intrigued and make people feel good about themselves. I was very impressed that we had an average IQ of 130, 540 people with an average IQ of 130. That might be representative of the whole population of countercurrents readers, or you know, that might be sort of the peak of it. But we have a very intelligent group of people reading our stuff. And when I founded Countercurrents in 2010, my idea was to create a webzine that would appeal to people with an IQ of 120 or above. And that was successful. I'm very, very pleased to see how many people with advanced degrees that we have, PhDs, master's degrees, law degrees, medical degrees. It doesn't surprise me, but I had these intuitions, but now I have data, and that's exciting. We've been running this movement for decades now based on intuitions and anecdotes, not on hard data. And that's a remarkable fact that we need to change. We've gone a long way this way, but we could have gone so much farther probably if we had actual objective data, not just data about ourselves, of course, but data about the public at large. And that's one of the things that Homeland Institute is doing. But I brought David on for this project, aside from the Homeland Institute, of just polling our readers, because I want to know who are already on our side. And then that will allow us to better mobilize the people who are already in our camp and appeal better to the population that isn't on our side yet. How do we do better outreach? Again, we've been doing this based on intuition and instinct and anecdotes for decades, and now we can do this based on hard data. I think this is quite revolutionary, and we're just beginning. So once we're done with this poll, we will analyze the results, and we'll make some tweaks to the questionnaire, to the website. We had a 22% failure to complete the poll rate. 78% of the people who signed up to complete it completed it, but 22% didn't. We'd like to know why. So we want to get that rate up. So there's a bunch of stuff we want to do to improve this, and then we're going to try and get other mailing lists to poll. And we would like to go from 540 to 10,000 people someday. And when we get numbers that large, that we can start seeing interesting patterns, things will start jumping out at us. Patterns in people's educations, patterns in people's religious beliefs, stuff like that, locations where people grew up. All of this can be extremely useful to us. Eventually, I would like to create polling. And this is going to require a large organization, a lot of money, but I'd like to be able to poll white people in every congressional district in America. Then we can really start having data that can be used for classic political pressure group stuff. We can basically go to congressmen and say, if you support this bill, we will make you lose because we have enough people in your district who listen to us and feel strongly about this that we can make a 2% shift in the outcome, and that's enough in your district to end your career.
Even if we don't have 2%, if we had even 0.5%, those people are willing to volunteer against them. That's big because volunteers, they're force multipliers. They get like 10 votes each. I don't know how many votes the average volunteer is, but any campaign, it's usually the politicians' friends and families and a smattering of other people. But if the opposition has a flush of volunteers, that is big.
Yeah. Yeah. So we eventually want to get to the point where we can be an effective political pressure group. And
like the ADL, yeah, but based.
Yeah. And that means that we have to be a force to be reckoned with. But to reckon, you have to have numbers. And we can't go around saying crazy alcohol and cocaine fueled nonsense like we memed Trump into the White House. Or 4 years later, we were the 5%.
We made him lose in 2020 because we stayed home, like all 300 of you in a barn. Let's get real. I like the, let's be realistic here.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it could be true, but it's probably not true, but it could be true. But here's the thing. It's not, no one's going to take it seriously unless you can show with facts and figures. And we need to get to the point where, first of all, we can grow the number of people who believe the things that we believe to the point where we are a force to be reckoned with politically. And second, we can demonstrate where they are and how committed they are and just how either dangerous or helpful to the political aspirations of particular candidates they are. And then we can start seeing politicians in this system catering to us for a change. And I think that time will come. We've already gotten to the point where politicians are talking about anti-white racism. That's huge. That has gone from the margins of the internet to the political mainstream in a decade.
Yeah. So a big part of that too is targeting rogue elites like Elon Musk. We had this huge, what's going on is that people talk about the Jewish question, race issues. A lot of these rogue elites, it's like people like Candace Owens, Jake Shields, are taking a jump into our politics. And what I want to do is I want to target individual rogue elites who might be adjacent to our ideas, create a profile based upon these answers. A lot of them are INTJs, so that's good. That's the ones we have the most of. And basically just look at all the different cross-sections that line up with him, like, okay, they're age, religion, background, wealth, personality type. And what's weird is if you go online, a lot of these people have already been profiled for Myers-Briggs. Like, all these historical figures have Myers-Briggs assigned to them, and it seems to be pretty scientific because they'll be in agreement 80% or more of the people who play this game agree on what people are, like Napoleon or whoever. So I can figure out what makes these people tick, and then I can then create a detailed game plan for how to radicalize them, what barriers we need to confront, and about how long it will take. And I think that could be big. I think that could really hasten radicalizing rogue leaders or making them realize they should play patty cake with us even if they don't fully agree with us. And this is the type of stuff that brought down the Soviet Union, because there are people like me, like I'm a little humble brag here. People like me brought down the Soviet Union. I mean, part of it was the Soviet Union's own incompetence, but there were people like me in U.S. Strategic Command in the bowels of their little dungeons, psychoanalyzing the Soviet power structure based upon where people were located in a photograph next to each other and how they're interacting and what we heard from this agent. And this is all, by the way, this isn't classified. This is all like open source history from the Cold War that's like said and done. But people did this type of stuff. And they did psychoanalyze leaders and how to like manipulate them or turn them or otherwise manipulate them. And this brought down the Soviet Union. And you know what? I'm going to bring down the American regime. I will radicalize these rogue elites. If I even do this with even onesie twosie, that's a huge breakthrough. Even if I make it happen 50% faster, that's a huge breakthrough. Mm-hmm. That's a game changer.
Yeah, you only have to get a couple of really brilliant and wealthy and influential people to flip. Look at what happened on Twitter when Elon Musk bought it, for instance. Individuals make a difference. And rogue elite members can upset the establishment tremendously. This is why they hate Trump so much. He is a traitor to their class. They had a cozy little game, a cozy gentleman's agreement worked out behind the scenes in their plush clubs that they would never compete on globalization, on immigration, etc. And he broke that cartel agreement and let that cat out of the bag. They will never forgive him for that. He was a traitor to the elites. He was a traitor to their attempt to basically impose this political hegemony with the fake sense of the illusion of political rivalry. You see, the way the system works is the people who rule it are on the same page about all the important stuff, and political debates and political campaigns are run around unimportant issues, unimportant to them, important to the voters, right? But unimportant ultimately to the people running things. Now, you have to wonder, well, these people invest a huge amount of passion in debating about things that we call unimportant. Yeah, they do. But still, ultimately to the system, they're unimportant. The way the systems work is the most important things are the things you're not allowed to debate about. You're not allowed to dissent about. And, you know, all the debate is around unimportant stuff, unimportant to the survival of the system. We have to create a counter-hegemony. Right now, the hegemonic system, and we're seeing this in action, just by the hysterical behavior of these lickspittle Republicans. What's sacred in America are Jews, Jewish interests. Jewish identity, those are sacred. Everything else has to bow down. Everything takes a back seat, right? And wouldn't it be nice if we had a society, a white society, historically white society, a normatively white society like America, where white identity and white interests are sacred, not the interests of foreigners? That's what white nationalism is, as I define it. And that white nationalism means a society where we'll be debating about things like abortion and taxes until the sun explodes. But we will never be debating about the question, do white people have a right to survive and flourish in their own countries, the countries they created? That debate will be off the table forever. And if you try and put that back on the table, you will be given a one-way ticket somewhere. Not a mental asylum, you know, to a country of your choice. That will not be allowed. That's going to be off the table, but everything else will be on the table. We won't have political debate about the most important things either. Certain things are sacrosanct in every society. We just happen to live in a society that was built by white people, that is populated by a white majority, that is sustained by a white majority, where white interests are not sacrosanct. In fact, whites are not sacrosanct. We are demonized. That is a total inversion. That is complete insanity. And we're going to remove that insanity and set things right. That's the goal. So anyway, let's go forward. We have a few more questions and we're already over 2 hours. K-Max writes in with another 10 US dollars. The survey had 91% male and only 9% female response. Is this a fear on birth rates if so few women identify, or broadly more ways to appeal to white women? Of the women we do have, are birth rates higher, desire for children higher among right-wing women? David's actually going to be analyzing that data soon about, you know, how fertile we are. There's a widespread assumption that I think is probably going to be borne out, that white nationalists are among the least fertile people in the population, just based on the people that I know, a lot of us don't have kids. So we're going to look into that. I don't think it's a terrible flaw that we are more than 91% male and 8-point-something% female. We're not doing ballroom dancing here. We don't need sex parity. But by the same token, we do need to think about how to reach out to women, how to persuade women of our issues and so forth. There's no question about it. And we have a number of extremely important female writers at Countercurrents, Margot Metroland, Clarissa Schnabel. There are others, Alex Graham. So we do have women's voices on our platform. We do want to have more women involved. Of course, when women are not a sexual minority, they're 50% of the population. And we need to figure out how to get them on our side more. So that's one of the things that we're going to definitely look into. David, do you want to say something?
Yeah. Yeah, so the INTJ personality type is not conducive towards touchy-feely stuff or relationships. And that is probably what's driving our low fertility rate. And two, for the women thing, that kind of goes back to Lauren Southern talking about how women have been driven off. Like, Countercurrents is very welcoming to women. So that's Lauren Southern, I think, is just making stuff up and being subversive. But two, it's, I think that most women are more, and they're not going to get into politics like this, where it's all abstract in history. They're going to actually practice them just quietly on their own, like actually have a family. And so I think the best way to get women involved is just to have our guys date them, and, you know, they'll follow suit eventually with these ideas. And if not, they'll still be raising a family, which is good. So it is, outreach to women is something I do want to explore, but it's also not a crippling weakness. I think it needs to just be accepted that politics, it's like war, it's like football, it's traditionally a masculine thing. I mean, we're talking about, you know, power and history and clash of civilizations. These are all male brain stuff. And so this is just naturally going to have more men. I didn't think it was going to be 90%. I prefer more like a 80-20 ratio. That'd be more balanced. And I think, too, there's also a problem here with, it's a self-replicating problem, because there's not a lot of women. So a lot of women come, they show up, and they're like, well, I'm 1 out of 10. This is awkward, especially if there's only like, you know, 9 to 10 people there already. They're the only woman. So as long as there's like, I noticed this too. I know some women who are nationalist, or they are the significant other nationalists. They do say they feel awkward when it's one woman and like 12 guys. And it's like, you know, it's like if you're a dude at a baby shower. I mean, I think baby showers are sometimes like both sexes attend now because of like modernism. But it'd be weird if you went to a traditional baby shower and you're the only guy there. It's like, I feel like I'm intruding. So I think this is a hurdle that once we pass it, somehow it will drastically drop, where it's like it'll be more of a ratio of 2/3 are men, 1/3 are women, or at the bare minimum, you know, 1/5 are women. But it's just, it's getting that thing where we need to have women show up to attract women, ironically. But I think that's going to change once this becomes more normalized. I think a key to this might just be having celebrities normalize this. Like, we have MMA fighters, which appeal to men, but having people that women like somehow get into this, like, at that point we're going to attract women, because this will be normal, more sociable, and that's what they're looking for.
Yeah.
But I will be paying attention to the women respondents very closely, especially with their red pill journey and their input.
Yeah, that's going to be very interesting to dig into. One thing that we cannot do and we cannot tolerate, and I have been intolerant of, is I remember back in 2017 when Nick Fuentes, because I don't know, maybe he was bored, there was the news cycle was slow or something, decided to start a crusade against women who were podcasters in our scene. People like Lauren Southern, Tara McCarthy, people like that. I wrote an article about this called Don't Let the Bastards Get You Down, because I just thought this was a despicable campaign, despicable behavior. You don't make a movement stronger by making it smaller. I'm sorry. And you know, I've not changed my mind about that. And I've not actually forgiven that. And I remember that. So we can't do that. Obviously, people who drive women away actively, need to be disciplined, shunned, penalized. And they'll just create, you can't throw them off the internet. By the same token, you shouldn't do anything to sustain them. So I do think that that's a factor that needs to be called out. Women are 50% of the population, and you can't just treat them like some minority that you want to deport someday. That's a strange mentality. Okay, so K-Max writes in with another $25, very generous, thank you. In comparing East Asian countries who have low birth rates like the Western countries do, but not import mass immigration, I can only see the difference of Jewish control over the Western nations that countries like Japan, China, South Korea do not have. Is it this simple, or are there other factors? What he's saying is that, the Japanese and the Chinese and the South Koreans have very low birth rates, but they don't have hostile elites championing open borders. And indeed, most of the people who've been saying for years that China or Japan needs to open its borders have not been Japanese. They've been journalists and politicians and economists in the West, many of whom are Jewish. And it's just sort of laughable. I caught onto this pattern a long time ago. It's like once a year, the New York Times would have some Berg calling for the Japanese to basically begin exterminating themselves with open borders. And only recently have they fallen for this just based on economic necessity. Now, the question is, why is it an economic necessity? Well, it's an economic necessity because they've created Ponzi scheme economics and Ponzi scheme social programs, welfare programs. And ultimately, what we need to do is change those social programs and economic systems. We do not want to destroy Japan so the stock market line goes up. That's crazy. The whole purpose of having an economy is to provide a life for its people. The idea that we should change the people and change a society beyond all recognition to keep the markets going is a complete inversion of reality. And the people who are pushing that are basically rootless people who have too much money and too much power, and maybe both of them need to be taken away from them just so we can get the system back under control. But we have to ultimately change the Ponzi economy and the Ponzi welfare state to reduce the pressure to have constantly growing populations and open borders when, as people say, the Japanese aren't having enough children now. Well, enough for what standard? Well, enough to sustain the particular system. There was a time when Japan was a great nation with half as many people as it has today. There is no reason why Japan couldn't be a great nation again with half as many people as it has today. The claim that they've got to have more people, and if they can't birth them, they've got to import them, is based on treating the current system as absolute rather than fungible. And that mentality has to change.
I think there's going to also be, I will probably write an article on this. I'm kind of busy analyzing the poll data, but about a instead of a racial reckoning, there's going to be an economic reckoning with debt to GDP ratio. Because America's debt to GDP ratio, it's 122% right now. Everyone spiked over due to COVID, but America is leading the way on this, but it's not the... there are a lot of other countries with very high debt to GDP ratios. Japan is 260%. I know some countries have like 40%. A lot of them are very high, like 80%. So at some point, this will explode and you can't pay it back. And I will explore all the different scenarios here, but these programs are not sustainable. And I personally think it's very selfish that people, you know, they want to have their Social Security, but they don't want to have kids to pay into it. And then they think they can do a quick fix of having some migrants come, and then the people who did have kids have to deal with the migrants and their problems. They're not economically viable long-term. It's only short-term, if that. And it wasn't sustainable. Like, this infinite growth model required people to have kids, and somebody just kind of forgot about that or didn't care. And this is why, also, You know the meme of everyone saying that their ideology will prevail after the collapse? I don't know which ideology or ideologies will prevail, but it will not be liberal democracy. I think liberal democracy will be shunned like Nazism is today. It will be completely verboten because this debt bomb will go off. It might be like 9/11 times 1,000. It will wreck everything. People will be incensed at the boomers, whether or not they're to blame or not. And it will be completely destroyed. Like they'll say, these countries destroyed themselves. They went crazy with daddy's credit card and threw this on us. We don't have a debt crisis. The people who caused it are all dead or senile. And it was liberal democracy that caused this because there's an incentive to plunder the country, as it's explained by Hans Hermer Hoppe in Democracy, the God That Failed. And there's no authority figure to think long-term, like either a king, monarch, a council, a party. There's nothing, even if it's just like random military vets who have some interest in the country or parents. There's no interest in long-term stuff. They only think in maybe quarterly profits or every 2 to 4 years for an election. So I think liberal democracy, it will be the ideology that is despised during the post-collapse. And then if you ask me, we're already in the collapse.
Yeah, yeah. Let's look at some of the questions that we've gotten from Odyssey. There's a whole raft of them over here. This is great. Thank you so much for everything you've been donating, folks. You can also send DLive tokens too. We will cash those in at the end of the year. So Heraclitus sends $5 on Odyssey. Why did the white elite turn on us? Well, that's a huge, huge question.
Part of it is that the elite, it's not the elite, it's the pseudo-elite. These aren't aristocrats of blood and soil. These aren't warriors or priests. These are simply money-grubbing merchants. So the elites, if you look at, I'm kind of compressing Yaki's history here, but America began with these starry-eyed ideals, and the problem with the Freemasons and the Founding Fathers is that they did not create a deep state. And also they failed to create an imperium, like Alexander Hamilton, who wanted a more centralized system. Well, nature abhors a vacuum. So all the industrialists took over. So these are money-grubbing people, and they started the war of northern aggression. And they're just big industrialists. They have no connection to the land. They have no sense of noble duty. And they're stupid people. They also don't have – there's no Bismarck. America didn't have a Bismarck who had a long-term vision. It was basically mostly people with short-term visions who were out to make a buck. Teddy Roosevelt was our best guy. He was the exception. But he had to fight entrenched business interests. Like, Manifest Destiny was done haphazardly without a Bismarck figure. This is simply a pure barbarian instinct kind of going wild on a hemisphere where there weren't any other white powers that could push back. Like, Canada, after some just unpleasantness in the War of 1812, was not a hostile power. So there is no competition. Either America wasn't forced to get serious or create a real elite to fight another elite, like, in another country. Like, even if Poland had been, you know, copy-pasted onto our continent, Poland would probably have conquered America because they had a serious politics and elite. But there is no competition. You cannot have a real elite. You have these fake people who make money. People who make money, merchants are not real elites. They're fake. And so these people, the Jews just kind of waltzed in and were able to displace these merchants. Like, they were either displaced or they went along with it. They had no connection to blood and soil. Who cared? Like, America was, people need to get this into their head that America was already a strip mall long before 2020. There's already this plunder mentality. Like, Spengler talks about the Viking mentality of plunder as opposed to the Prussian idea of knightly service. So the Jews just kind of walked in. Like, Captain Codorno of Romania is right. The country has the Jews it deserves. The Jews found a wonderful home here because it's all about making a buck. So this all happened in the 1930s, and it wasn't just that they hate us, it's that they were just wholly indifferent. They were like, whatever. They're already, you know, abusing white factory workers. That was a short step to just go along the Jews and abuse the goyim even more. And that was that. And the elites also had no sense of innate loyalty to each other, so they weren't able to eject the Jews and say, no, this is a white Anglo-Saxon elite, not you. So they just got into the country club too because they look kind of similar. So they just went downhill from there. And of course, Europe, it's the post-World War II order where America enforced its stupid ideas and its evil elites and money-grubbing merchant types on Europe.
Yeah, yeah, that basically says it. Friedrich writes in with 10 US dollars. He says, hello, great show. Did the poll reveal anything interesting on the Dark Triad? How did we fare? Thank you. Well, I can tell you my dark triad profile. I came out very low on sociopathy and narcissism, like practically nothing, and rather high on Machiavellianism, which I think is an interesting pattern. And I was going to ask David about this, what the patterns have been on the dark triad results. Have you had a chance to analyze that yet?
I unfortunately have not, because that is towards the end. So I did most of the first analysis for simply all people in general. That one's a little bit more difficult because it's, I have to use charts and graphs because it's a number as opposed to an answer. So I'm going to get to that too. Right now I'm still slogging for this first section. I've done most of the questions for DIST in general. That one I haven't, because it's going to be a little bit more intense. Right now I'm also slogging through the cross-referencing data with different data sets for the first part. But it did seem that there was a lot of just from what I saw when I was going to see through it, seemed like there was a lot of people with supposed narcissism and Machiavellianism, which I also have. But this is a normie test. And we need to keep in mind that the normie test doesn't apply to us well, because the average IQ here is 130. So yes, we are better than most people. That's not bragging, it's just a fact.
Yeah.
And two, the Machiavellianism, it's just common sense. Like, I'm sorry, I hate this whole, like, you know, we have to put everything on Instagram. Like, maybe we should, yes, I think you should keep secrets. I don't think you need to tell the whole world your whole daily routine every single day. I don't think, and two, I'm an attorney. I used to work in military intelligence. I think when you are told something in confidence, or you infer that something that's being told in confidence, you maybe shouldn't gossip about it to people. I think that's not a sign of being slimy. I think it's a sign of honor, actually, and of being dependable.
Yeah, a lot of these questions have certain questionable assumptions. Let's put it that way. But still, it's interesting to see what the results are and compare it with normies who take the same tests. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing that too. Green Party sends 10 US dollars. Thank you. What do you think of this sphere, not sure how to name them, that encompasses Passage Press, BAP, Revolver News, etc., same side as us? Well, you mean basically Jewish nationalistic types. So BAP is Kostin Alamariu, Bronze Age pervert, he's Jewish. Passage Press, run by Jonathan Kieperman, recently outed as Jewish. I don't know what IM 1776 is. You name that too. Revolver News, run by Darren Beatty, Jewish. Same side as us? Well, yes and no. Depends on the issue. If it's issues related to the left-right distinction, populism versus libtardism, Trumpism versus cuckservatism, yeah, a lot of their takes are valid, and I agree with them. But ultimately, what I'm about is white identity politics. Like I said earlier, I want a society in which white identity and white interests are sacrosanct. Now, I cannot reasonably expect Darren Beatty or Kostin Alamariu or Jonathan Kieperman to sign off on that. So, not on the same side with me. But I think it's good that their names are now known. Their ethnicity is known. Their ethnic biases and loyalties can be monitored. Let's just put it that way. We can be aware. We can know what to look for. And again, we can't purge them from the internet. We can't make them go away. But they should also not be seen as us, ultimately. In the final analysis, they're not us. They can be useful. And I've said this many times. You know, Chaya Raichik, I guess that's her name, libs of TikTok. What she does is orthogonal to white identity politics, but still I'm very, very pleased that she's doing it. She's been doxxed, she's surviving, she's flourishing, actually. And if she wants to use some of her Jewish insider cred and Jewish insider powers to move the needle on something that's useful to us, then I'm not going to say that she's a bad person doing bad things. If Amy Wax, is it Amy Wax? Yeah, it's Amy Wax. I was confusing her for a second with Ruby Wax, who's like a comedy writer in the UK. Amy Wax at the University of Pennsylvania. She's used a lot of her Jewish insider power and cred to platform people like Jared Taylor. More power to her. I'm not going to refuse that. So I'm not going to say that Jews can't do useful things for white identity politics on issues that are not absolutely identical to white identity politics, but I can't ultimately believe that they are going to sign off on white identity politics as such, because I don't think they believe deep down in their hearts that they are white. They might pose as fellow white people. We see that a lot on Twitter, but I don't think that that's how they ultimately will see themselves. And therefore, I believe there's a deep conflict of interest there.
My two cents is that they are welcome to. First of all, I don't like doxing in general because I was doxed. I think doxers should face severe consequences. I'll just say that. But they're welcome to play with our history, our culture, and our politics. I'm not one of these like oversensitive third-generation Guatemalans shrieking about cultural appropriation. But we are the final arbiters on how our history and culture is interpreted, like Greek stuff or Nietzsche, because that's white boy stuff. And we're also the final arbiters on our politics, on our interests, and how we will confront Jewish power, not them.
Yeah, well said. So we have $5 from Heraclitus. Oh, great learned men who run a community with a sampled IQ score north of 120. How do you analyze phenomena in order to understand what is happening so that we can respond best? Well, we've been sort of doing that. You just use reason and intuition and gather facts and try and draw conclusions. And he also writes in with another $1. Thank you. 90% of men dying is what happened after the War of the Triple Alliance, wasn't it? I don't know if that's true or not. David, do you know anything about the death toll in the War of the Triple Alliance?
I do not, unfortunately. I know Germany lost about 30% of its population during the 30 Years' War, but that was men and women both.
Yeah.
So I can't speak to the Triple Alliance death rate.
Yeah. Jay Kahn writes in with $5. Thank you. I think this comes down to being part of God's plan, mysterious or not. It is defiantly frustrating, but no one can predict the future. Vote locally and look out for your neighbors. Heraclitus writes in with 0.5 Libri tokens. We have problems with lack of diversity within our immutable group. Very well. We shall adapt, improve, or improvise and overcome. Thank you. Bored Troll has donated one ice cream at DLive. Thank you. White Capability is sent in $10. I'm glad you touched on the necessity evolving women are a movement. If we don't come together, we'll achieve nothing. And we have $1 from Heraclitus on Odyssey. Bismarck had a vision. Where do I learn more? Is there a good book that you know on Bismarck?
Unfortunately, I do not. I've basically just cobbled together different articles on him over time.
Yeah.
I wish I could recommend a good book, but I can't.
Yeah. Well, that's great. So that seems to do it. Let me just make one quick check over at Entropy. We are past 2 hours and 30 minutes now, so we do want to wrap this up before everyone falls asleep. No more at Entropy, no more at Odyssey. Folks, thank you so much. This has been great. Next week, the show will be hosted by our guy, Angelo Plume, also known as Pox Populi. Angelo will be here. Guest to be determined. He might just do a monologue. He's really good at that. So tune in next week to Countercurrents Radio. David, how do people follow your work?
Yes, so they can follow me on X, formerly known as Twitter. It's at David Zuddy. It's an unusual last name, so it should be easy to find at David ZSUTTY. I also write on Countercurrents. And the Holman Institute, you can go to there and see your work there. It's https://holmaninstitute.org.
Thank you. So I want to thank everybody in the audience. We were up to about 100 people today. I want to thank the donors. You've been very kind. I want to thank the moderator. You always do great work. And I think that does it. I want to thank David, of course, for taking the time out. So we will be back next week with Angelo Plume at the microphone. And until then, just keep reading Countercurrents. Thank you.